What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Welcome to Living Your Life with Leanne Lang, recorded from home and with the help of John Milkey from Blast Podcast. How does one even approach the subject of mindfulness? Where does one start? Is there actually a beginning, middle, and end? Is everyone's path the same? Are our experiences or outcomes supposed to be similar? And how does one really quiet the mind? I mean, really, it's always thinking. It's always working. If I'm breathing, the mind is working. Isn't that right? And what exactly is the difference when people talk about mindfulness or meditation, or mindfulness meditation, and all the other forms of meditation that we're hearing about? So before I get ahead of myself, I really want you today to be open-minded and cognizant of what you will learn and how you can apply it to your own life. As many of you know, I credit meditation as the game changer for me. I started it about a year ago, and I'm beyond grateful that I stuck with it. We are going through unprecedented time that impacting our life, our health, our freedoms, work, finances, and it's also a profound time of uncertainty, collective fear, and anxiety. So I really hope that you will embark on this journey with us today. Joining us is Jennifer Innes, the founder of Ottawa Meditation and Wellness. Jennifer is a UMass and UCSD trained mindfulness, mindfulness-based stress reduction, and mindfulness self-compassion trained teacher. Jennifer's story and her own path to this practice and profession is amazing in itself, and I can't wait to share that with you. Plus, as soon as I tell you the fact that she's actually a former spy, I think that's going to grab your attention as well. So, Jen, it is so great to have you joining us. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Leanne. It's great to be here.
I'm excited for our chat. Let me ask, like, have you meditated already today?
I have a couple of times, actually. Yeah.
A couple of times?
Yeah. So I did a longer one early in the morning and just a short one before I got on board here. How about you?
No, I actually haven't. I saved mine for the end of the day. It's funny.
Oh, okay.
Like for me, the mornings kind of get going and I know I should practice, you know, the gratitude and sitting and reflecting. But my mornings, I need to kind of get going. And I find it's at night when I like to bring myself back down. And so I always do it at night when the kids are taking a shower or a bath or kind of getting ready for bed. I kind of put myself out and sit down and I probably go for about a half hour and that's my downtime. But I realize it's different for everyone, right?
It is. Absolutely. You've got to do what works for you. And I think the key thing is the commitment. And it's with that commitment that we start to develop the benefits of the practice.
Well, when you say it's the commitment, this is something I think that for a lot of people, I think it throws them off because they don't want to be committed that long before they actually see something that's going to benefit them, right? Because I find people are like, I don't have the time to invest in learning or figuring out how to do it to be able to get the benefits from it. Do you hear that often?
Absolutely. And so it's not a quick fix. It is a process of really committing and sticking with the practice. But those who do stick with it certainly do begin to experience those benefits. And the beautiful thing about this practice is there's no end to it. And so you talk about a beginning, middle, and end to it. You can really do this forever and continue to deepen in the practice. And I like what Jon Kabat-Zinn says. He says that the practice teaches you what you need to know. And so it can really be quite individual for each person in terms of what they're learning in this particular practice. Now, I'm not sure what practice you engage in, but certainly mindfulness meditation is a particular kind of meditation. So some of the benefits that we might experience with this kind of practice will differ than what you might experience, for example, in transcendental meditation or a mantra-based practice. And so maybe we can talk a little bit about these.
Well, absolutely, because Jennifer, I was going to get to all of that, trust me, because trust me, my list is pretty big. And I do want to be able to break that down because I think a lot of people are getting these apps, you know, you've got these Calm and this Headspace. And so you have people talking through, you know, you have people that are talking you through it. Or if you go to YouTube, you'll have different music or or people talking about finding yourself in space. And I think for those that are open to the concept and want to be able to be and live in this, you know, in this experience, a lot of us don't really know what it is that we're actually doing when we sit down and do, I don't know, like a YouTube video, or if we do an app, or if we just sit in silence. And I think people really do need to understand the difference and what those really apply to. So yeah, let's hit on that. But then I'm going to force you, as I had intended, to go back to the beginning, because I really want to get to your story as well. But really briefly, if you can, so people know what we're going to be getting into, break down what, how you consider the difference between meditation, mindfulness, and the other one, and mindfulness meditation.
Yeah. And so basically, meditation is just the umbrella term for the various practices that are out there. And mindfulness meditation is just one grouping of practices. So transcendental, mantra, or other types. So we use the term just like we would use the term fitness to talk about a variety of different physical activities. And so in mindfulness meditation, there's also a number of different practices and different, you know, traditions and lineages. But basically, mindfulness itself, there's not one authoritative definition of mindfulness, because mindfulness is actually preconceptual. It's something that we can all experience, but we actually need to experience it to understand it fully. But that said, you know, there are a number of different definitions out there. And the one I like to use is Jon Kabat-Zinn's, because it tends to be cited most frequently. And so really what mindfulness is paying attention on purpose in the present moment without judgment. And so there's really three aspects to what mindfulness is. There's the present moment aspect of it. So we're in the present moment, but that's not enough. And I like that one of my teachers makes the comparison to a black lab running around in a dog park, very present, but not mindful. So human beings have the capacity for observing their own mind. So this meta awareness capacity, metacognitive capacity that dogs don't have. And so that's the second aspect of it. And the third aspect of it is really important, and it has to do with how we're relating to our experience. And so are we relating to it with some kind of aversion? So the idea is we want to be relating to our experience without judgment, without that overlay of thought and judgment. And so mindfulness meditation is actually the practice of cultivating this quality of mindfulness, that in doing so, it becomes more readily available to us. And so when it becomes readily available, we can actually benefit and tap into its many benefits. And there are so many benefits. I don't want to overstate the benefits, but and there's certainly a lot of research being done right now. And again, I don't want to go too much into that, but just to give you sort of an idea, I think that today there are 8,000 research papers out there, half of which have been produced in the last 6 or so years, touching just about every imaginable health-related issue and the effects of mindfulness or meditation in these particular areas. And so the big three benefits, really, where there's a consistent and strong body of evidence, is in the area of depression, anxiety, and chronic pain. And of course, there are other benefits like attention, the ability to sustain the attention for longer, and cognitive flexibility. And there's some amazing brain changes, including, you know, increased gray matter and cortical density in certain key regions of the brain. I'm just trying to, just in terms of our ability to meet stress with more ease, both chronic stress, which is long-term stress, and acute stress, just to name a few. And I think some of the obvious ones that I found really early on in my practice is that when you're spending, maybe you start with a 20-minute practice or you're starting with 30, and you're spending 30 minutes turning the attention inward, inevitably, you're going to increase your own self-awareness. And through that process, your own clarity about what's important to you, what are some of the areas that, you know, we want to improve in our lives, just in terms of, you know, whatever it is we're doing, but also as human beings. So I feel that this practice, for those who stick with it, it does take not only a commitment, but a certain interest and in one's own experience and honesty, because at the end of the day, we're going to bump up or we're going to bump into things that we don't necessarily like that we see. We're all human beings. We've done things that, you know, maybe we're not proud of or are, you know, aren't things that we like about ourselves. And so it really does require this honesty, but also this gentle, non-judgmental attitude when we're exploring our inner life. So the mind, body, and heart as we delve in. And so I think that's really important to remember. Yeah.
You know, people, you know, you talk about the studies and all of the things that it's able to do, you know, for our brains. And you listed a couple of different things, but at the end of the day, people are looking to find more joy, be more mindful, be more present. Yeah. Like for some people, they just want to be living in a bit of more of the present moment, to be able to look and appreciate the things around them or their kids, or taking a second to step back and realize life is moving so fast. Like, how do I be able to almost sometimes slow things down?
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you're pointing to something really interesting. And Dan Harris wrote the book, 10% Happier.
I love that book.
Yeah, and I think I recently heard that he just pulled that number out of a hat. Really, the 10% isn't based in science necessarily. But certainly, I think where the happiness comes in is really learning to access the present moment more often. I mean, really, that is where happiness lies. And, you know, you talked about mind wandering or just having a busy mind at the beginning of the podcast. And that's the biggest complaint that people have, and often a misconception of mindfulness meditation practice, is that we're supposed to be blanking the mind, and that's not at all the case. In fact, we're learning to observe our own thoughts and patterns and where we get stuck in these mental ruts. And another really interesting study is that Harvard University found that 46.9% of the time our mind is wandering, and that a wandering mind is an unhappy mind. What I love about this study is that the predictor of happiness didn't have to do with what you were doing, but whether you were engaged doing it. So in other words, if you were having a piece of chocolate cake but weren't really paying attention or savoring it, you weren't really enjoying it. And isn't that true? I mean, often, and I'm finding during this pandemic even, that, you know, life is shrinking in many ways, and I'm just finding myself where, you know, where there's gratitude just naturally arising more often. And I think that it has to do with, I'm not sure what it has to do with actually exactly, but this is where, again, you talked about gratitude practice. For me, I feel that this is really where happiness also lies, is in really appreciating those moments where we feel grateful for what we have. And so that unhappy mind is a wandering mind, is when we get stuck in past and future, and we start thinking about problems or looking for problems. And usually that story of past and future looking for problems tends to revolve around the story of me. And so, again, these are some of the things they're discovering in the brain. So the default mode network of the brain is an area of the brain that actually becomes quite highly active when the mind is at rest. So when the mind doesn't have a particular task to engage in, we actually become quite highly active in terms of thinking about past, future, looking for problems, and thinking about our own problems, essentially. And so they find that meditators, actually, the default mode network quiets down, not only during meditation, but outside of meditation. So again, this practice of mindfulness can offer some freedom from that part of our existence, which is almost 50% of the time, this mind being lost in thought. And we're like walking heads a lot of the time, completely disconnected from our body. And so these practices teach us to bring the attention inward into the body, to connect with what's going on in the body. And that is the gateway to the present moment. It's in the body, because the body can be here anywhere. The body is always present. Thoughts can be anywhere, anytime. And so this practice, again, of bringing the attention inward is part of it.
I think what's interesting is just if you have the ability to recognize that you're in the monkey brain. That
yes.
Like I found for me, the starting point was just recognizing that I was constantly thinking past or future. And, you know, I couldn't control. It was like my thoughts were getting ahead of me. And it was then when I kind of was like, how do I tame this? Like, and that was, for me, was the introduction. It was because I actually one day just became very aware that I had that moving brain. And I think for a lot of people, that's almost the trigger. That's even to recognize that that's what's happening is a step forward in itself.
Absolutely.
That awareness.
Absolutely. And it usually is the first insight that people bump into when they start a meditation practice, is just how crazy our minds really are. They're like an out of control thought generator a lot of the time. And so that's a huge insight. And what's beautiful about it is that we can train the attention to be more present, less reactive, and also to begin to recognize our own patterns of thinking. And this is where we can get into mental ruts with, you know, whether it's depression or anxiety or whatever else, is often, you know, our own thoughts create a lot of these problems. Not all. I mean, obviously, thinking is an important part of our existence, but it can get in the way and cause problems.
The one thing that you mentioned a couple of minutes ago was that most people have the thought that we're supposed to get the mind to just clear, to be still, which seems like an impossible task. But what did you mean by that's not what it is that we're looking to do, to have stillness? That's not how it works.
Yeah, and I think that's where there is confusion between the various practices, because I know that in certain yogic practices, that is the goal, is to clear the mind. And so mantra-based meditations will tend to have, well, whether they have that effect or not, I'm not entirely sure, but that is the goal. But in mindfulness, what we're actually learning to do is to see really clearly what's actually going on. So to see clearly reality. And so to see clearly reality, we need to attend to whatever is present in a given moment. And that may not be something pleasant. It could be a lot of restlessness. It could be a lot of thinking. And so we want to be aware of what's actually happening, but we also don't want to get lost in it. And so the practice is coming back to whatever anchor that we're working with. So if often we begin with the breath awareness practice, but you know, the breath for some people is not a neutral place, but let's just say we begin with the breath awareness practice. The mind would wander off and we just continually bring it back to this feeling of the breath as it moves in and through the body. And it doesn't matter how many times we need to do that. It may be 100 times in a practice. The key thing, again, is not to judge ourselves for it. And so this is the nature of mind. This is how minds work, but it can be trained. And then over time, the mind does begin to settle, and, you know, whether it's entirely blank, I mean, some people can achieve that, but it's just simply, it's not the goal in this practice.
I think to be forgiving, especially people, if they are practicing mindfulness. So you talk about having that anchor, which for many beginners, right, it does. It starts with the breath, just, you know, the focus on breathing in and breathing out. And you'd be sitting there and you're kind of trying to count the breathe in, you know, or you count and then you realize that you're thinking about, I should have put this on the grocery list. And then this, you know, you start to say, oh, I'm not thinking anymore about just breathing. And so that's what you're referring to coming back to the anchor, is that you recognize the thoughts have left and then you just come back. And that's what you're saying. That could happen 100 times in a meditation practice, but it's the training of the coming back to the anchor is where you talk about the practice, right? That's the practice of bringing it back.
That exactly. And every time you do is a moment of mindfulness. And so when you just simply notice where your mind went off to, you might just, you know, say a gentle note, planning, remembering or thinking, hearing, and then bring the attention back. And it's when we get lost in the thought, which we often do, but wake up. So when we wake up, there's the moment of mindfulness, then we bring the attention back. And so that's the discipline of bringing the attention back. And so there is a huge attentional training component of this practice as well, which is really important, particularly in our day and age where we're constantly, you know, bombarded with information, or phones are going off and notifications. So the attentional training has a huge benefit. And I would even argue is one of the most important things we can do for ourselves, because at the end of the day, a scattered mind has no power. It's difficult to really be in charge of our lives. And we, you know, if we feel like we're chickens running around with our head cut off, you know, or we end up at the end of the day wondering what we accomplished because we were pulled here, there, and everywhere. And so this ability to maintain attention has huge benefits.
So I want people to understand that it's not that you get really good, like when people talk about the benefits of this, it's not that you get really good when you're sitting in a meditation of coming back to your anchor. It's how it applies when you're not in a meditation, and how it applies to how you cope and deal with your everyday life. That's where you see the benefits, right? It's not about being a really good meditator, and I think people need to understand that part.
Yeah, and the way I like to explain it, and I'm not sure who I heard it from, but it's like being in a laboratory. So the sitting practice, if you're doing a sitting practice, is the laboratory. And so you're learning things about yourself in that space because it's, you know, fairly calm, you're staying put. And so there are insights or experience, or not experiences, but understandings that you'll have during that practice that you can take those learnings and apply them in your day-to-day life, exactly what you just said. And it's interesting, you remind me of a participant in one of my workshops at one point. He was asking me, what's the point in going on a silent retreat if you're just going to end up coming back and, you know, being thrown into the busyness of your daily life? Isn't it kind of a waste of time? Again, no, because it's a training where it's, think of it as being a scientist in your own life, investigating it, discovering things, learnings, and then applying them.
Okay, so you brought it up. So I'm going to go, let's just press pause for a second, because you've just brought up the silent retreat. So it was funny, because as I was reading through things and looking through the work that you've done, I was under the impression that you really came into this practice kind of in your early 40s, of this was something that was introduced and this was a shift you made. But in a conversation that we had, because you went on a, because we're going to get to the fact that you went on a 12-day silent retreat, but this was actually something that you experienced as a child. So meditation, or this mindfulness, was something you were actually introduced to very young, before you came back to it in your 40s.
Right. Well, I wouldn't say I didn't have a practice, but I had a father who's basically been practicing for, I don't know, maybe 40 years now. And so I was always, you know, he spoke about it, but I didn't actually have a particular, you know, a practice. I did do yoga for about 20 years, but it wasn't until I arrived at a certain point in my life where I felt just really overwhelmed. And I remember thinking to myself that from the outside looking in, my life looked perfect, but on the inside, things weren't feeling so perfect. And so I decided it was time to do something about it. And I had the name of a meditation teacher in my phone that had been sitting there for 5 years that someone had given me when I was at the, you know, the green door. And I decided to give her a call. And so I just had one-on-one sessions with her for 4 sessions. And she gave me a recording. It was a 20-minute recording, is how I began. And I just committed wholeheartedly. I did it every single day. I don't know how many months I listened to her particular practice. And I just began to experience benefits, and it just grew from there. And today I practice maybe an hour a day, sometimes more. And on those rare days where I can't practice, I really feel it. And let me tell you, so do my kids. So they're big supporters of this practice. And so here I am. And I decided as well that I wanted to learn more. And so I embarked on the teacher training, and here I am sharing it with others, teaching it.
Okay, you did, in over the course of time, you did go on a 12-day.
It was actually a 19-day. So
oh my
it was,
God.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought 12 was crushing it, okay.
Yeah.
19 days.
Yeah, it was 19 days. But, you know, I have to let you, for some people, you know, some people do 3-month retreats or longer, you know. So it's, there's a whole retreat world out there, I guess you could say. And the retreats that I'm familiar with are the Vipassana or insight meditation retreats, not the Goenka ones. I haven't done one of those, but usually they are 3, 5, 7-day long retreats or longer. So it could be a month long, 3 months. And again, some people do it for a year or more, if you can believe it.
Okay. What's the point? You know, and what's the difference between going silent for 2 days or 5 days or 7 or 19, like you did? Like, what are you embarking on? And what is it that you need to say, I need to go and do this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think really it's where each person is at on this path. And because it is a path of understanding about our own experience, about the nature of things. So depending where people are, they're looking for different things. I mean, some people, again, come to this practice as a way to alleviate a little bit of stress in their life. There may be some general curiosity. Other people are taking it to a far deeper level, where it's really their life and their spiritual practice. And so, and a lot of it depends on how much time you have as well. And it just so happened that 19-day retreat, my kids were all at sleepaway camp for the month, so it really worked out well. But certainly it's an amazing experience. And I remember after the first one I did, which was with Tara Brach, I finished and I remember thinking to myself, everyone should do this at least once. You know, again, when you think about it, you're meditating for, I don't know, 12, 14 hours a day. And so what you're going to come out of that experience with is going to be a lot. because you're spending time with yourself, with your own experience, and it can be just incredibly enriching on so many levels, but hard too.
Right. Like sometimes people have a hard time just sitting through a car ride, you know, without music playing, just silence. Like you think of what people are capable of being within their own thoughts. And I'm thinking for people who would have experienced trauma or difficult things to sit with that in silence with nothing else, but to have to come to terms or to go through it or to re-experience it. Like how does that, when you're sitting through, it fascinates me because I can't understand being able to sit that long and have to experience things.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe I should clarify because it's, there is a format and the ones that I've been on are with amazing teachers. And so the support is huge. And so it's not like you're left to your own devices with your mind not knowing what to do. And so maybe I'll just briefly talk about the format. And so you wake up between 5 and 6, there's a movement, mindful movement practice in the morning. And then basically you alternate between walking and sitting meditation for pretty much the entirety of the day. 45 minute practices, but at the beginning they'll set you up for the day. So it will be a guided meditation, and there's an opportunity, for Q&A after that first guided practice. So you know what you're supposed to be doing during the day, and so you're really working with those instructions. And you feel supported as well because there is, let's say on a week-long retreat, you would meet at least once one-on-one with your teacher, and then once in a group setting, and sometimes more. So there's an opportunity to ask questions and just bring up whatever may be coming up for you. Or you can write a note at any time to your teacher. So it's not like you're left hanging. And then at the end of the day, there's a Dharma talk. So a Dharma talk is just a talk about the teachings of the Buddha. And it's not at all religious. It doesn't feel that way at all. It's just about the teachings. And just to be clear, the teachings of the Buddha is really, it's not buying into anything. It's not a belief system. It's really, here are these instructions. Go see for yourself. See how it works for you. So that's really how it works. And these Dharma talks are very helpful, actually, in terms of understanding the practice, understanding our own mind, understanding the struggles we're going through, the restlessness, the mind that doesn't stop, the anxiety that's arising during practice, or full-on fear. And so again, during these retreats, the teachers who lead them are highly experienced, and so they know how to guide in terms of trauma as well. There's certain instructions that we do suggest for people who have trauma, and ways to get back into their window of tolerance, because what often happens, or what can happen with people with trauma, is that they can get outside of that zone, particularly when they're bringing the attention inward. And so often the suggestion is to have some kind of grounding, feeling the feet on the floor, feeling, the floor beneath your feet and whatnot. So to bring yourself back. And this is why the breath is not always a neutral place for everybody. So people with trauma don't always feel at ease bringing the attention to the breath. And also reason why we always give the option to keep the eyes open during a practice too.
A lot of people will think, okay, it's all about deep breathing and your eyes are closed and you're sitting in a certain position. But that's, I think they need to understand that's not going to be the case. They could be sitting or lying or eyes open. So we all kind of tend to have our own judgment or thoughts about what we think it is. And that's not necessarily the case.
No, exactly. And it's a learning process. I think the key thing to understand is that you can't really do it, get it wrong. I think a lot of people worry, or they get, am I doing it right? And if I'm not doing it right, they give up and they just move on to something else. And so I think it is really important to understand you can't really mess it up. I think as long as you really,
okay, wait. I'm thinking like day 5 of a silent retreat and you just want to scream. That's like, I give up. Some people don't last. I've read a number of books, right, from people who like went in with the best of intentions, and after 2, 3, 4, 5 days were just like, they couldn't last. So what happens when someone like you can make it through 19 days and others can't? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so again, just to pick up on that point, if you have a teacher who's well experienced, that actually is really amazing material to be working with. The fact that you feel that you cannot stay is it an area to investigate? So how does that feel in your body? How are you in relationship to this experience? And so, again, we're not, with mindfulness meditation, we're not trying to achieve any particular state, not even relaxation. It's really about becoming very clear on what's actually happening right now. And so if what is actually happening is that you feel like you're jumping out of your skin, the invitation would actually to become really curious about what that feels like. What thoughts are here? How does that feel in your body? What happens to that feeling? Does it go away? How long does it take to go away? Does additional thinking fuel the feeling even more? Or if you bring your attention into the body, into the breath, does it leave? Is there an impermanence to how you're feeling? Is it just ebbs and flows, this arising, lingering for a while and passing away, which is another insight that we inevitably do bump into, is this truth of impermanence. And the difference between an insight and a cognitive or a conceptual understanding is we can often say, oh yeah, I get it, everything's always changing. But to experience it during a practice at that level is a different experience.
What did you gain from it? Was there a point in there where you're just, you know, you had that, like, I'm using like air quotes, like an enlightenment, mm-hmm. you know, is there such thing as like this enlightenment or this, you know, pot of gold or this ray of light at the end of the rainbow, you know, what is that?
So I think it's just a deepening understanding of all aspects of our experience, right? So getting to know our own mind, getting to know our own emotions, how we are in relationship to them. Is it serving me? Is how I am in relationship to these emotions, this fear that I might have? You know, how is this holding me back? So it's really a process of insight. So we bump into these insights in different ways. It's never the same experience for everybody. And so it's just, think of it more as a process of deepening our understanding. And I find it funny, like almost at the end of every retreat, the teachers will prepare us for going home. And they usually start that talk off with, so when you get home, everyone's going to ask you, friends and family are going to say, so what'd you do for the last week? And everyone bursts out laughing. And the reason why is it's hard to explain. It doesn't look like much is going on, but there's so much going on under the hood. So I don't know if that was helpful at all, but.
No, yes, there's a lot going on under the hood. And we all have a lot going on under the hood.
Yes, exactly.
It's being brave enough to go figure out how to make it run smoothly.
Yeah. And I.
Right. There's a lot of grease. There's a lot of buildup. There's a lot of buildup under the hood.
Exactly. And so I think then the first step is the recognition of what's actually there to begin with. And I love how Joseph Campbell, who's an American philosopher, talks about the circle of awareness with a line running through the middle. So everything above the line is within our awareness, and everything below the line is outside of our awareness. And so what happens often is we push down unpleasant things, unpleasant emotions that you were just talking about. And so mindfulness brings a lot of these things to the fore, into our awareness. And it's only once it's in our awareness can we actually begin to apply a lot of these tools, because really mindfulness learning, these practices are tools to support us when we're in the midst of difficulty. And often this difficulty, you know, can be around certain emotions, grief, loss, fear, anxiety. You know, this pandemic, I'm sure, is just bringing up so many different emotions for everybody. And maybe I can just speak a little bit to my own experience with fear. It was an area that I had an almost debilitating fear of public speaking.
Well, you're doing a great job right now, so thank you for that.
No, thank you. No. So anyway, so a lot of fear with that. And so I don't know how I managed to get through most of my life avoiding it at all costs, but I did. And what I realized, again, back to this circle of awareness, is that this fear that I had around speaking, even in a small group, actually, I was just pushing it down. I was resisting it. And I love the saying that what you resist persists, but what you feel, you can heal. And so I realized that this fear was not going away. Avoiding it was not going to help me, and that it was really holding me back in my life. And so I decided to do something about it. And I would say that mindfulness was really instrumental in allowing me to overcome it. And it's, when I say overcome, I should say move beyond it, because it's not like it goes away permanently. You know, you do have these moments of fear, but now I know how to be in wise relationship with it. I'm not pushing it away. I'm not condemning myself. You know, why do I have this fear? This feels so yucky. I want to get rid of it. I know how to actually invite it in with this kind curiosity and stay, to trust that it's okay to stay with this feeling.
Was there something that triggered it? Like, was there something as a child that triggered the inability or that fear of speaking in public?
I do think there was. And this is an interesting thing that you're raising, because I find in my workshops, participants often go to the why. And the why is important, but this is also why psychology and mindfulness work well together. Psychology asks about the why. Mindfulness is about the how. And so I think I do, you know, I think it does relate to a school experience, actually, but I wouldn't know for sure. But from the perspective of mindfulness, we wouldn't invite going into the story of why. Not that it's not important, it's just a different approach. It's more about what is here right now. How am I in relationship to this fear? Can I stay with this feeling? Can I trust it? Almost befriend it. So at one point, I remember imagining the fear sitting beside me, putting my arm around it and saying, it's okay. You can be here right now. You know, you're part of me right now, and we're going to get through this together. And, you know, so this stuff really works. You know, it really works. It's about turning toward our experience, befriending it and being curious about it.
Can you repeat the quote? Because I think if that would be something you almost have like pinned on a vision board, that it persists. If you could go through it again.
Yeah. So what you resist persists, and what you feel you can heal. And there's an equation by Shinzen Yang, and he says that pain times resistance equals suffering. So pain we cannot avoid. We all experience it, but the resistance that we add, we have some control over. When we add resistance, we actually create our own suffering. So we add that extra layer, and, you know, we can, again, as the practice deepens, we can start to see in our own experience what we're resisting and how that does actually create additional suffering. And you might just take pain or a little bit of tension in the body. So if you feel tension in the body and you're kind of resisting it and you're feeling all tense, you know, you're holding your body, it actually increases the tension to some degree. And if you're able to relax back and simply feel it, it can ease it a bit. So that's just a simple example around sensation in the body, but it works in the same way with emotions.
Hmm. Would it apply to like its emotions of anxiety, stress? I mean, I know something that you had come through was just emotional eating, or, you know, coming about it. And I know that you had that experience and that you're okay to share it, but can you share, because it's great when you talk from experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
Areas.
Mm-hmm.
So how was that effective, or how did you view emotional eating and bring it into the meditation?
Yeah. And so, I mean, the thing about this practice is that it's not just it has real life application. But it's important to understand, again, not a quick fix. It's something that deepens over time. And so the more we practice, the more we're able to see subtle aspects of our experience. So what I mean by subtle is that we can pick up on certain thought patterns, certain emotions that we hadn't noticed that were there before. And so one way that mindfulness can help us too is to interrupt bad habits, so unhelpful habits. So I noticed at a particular time in my life where I was going through a difficult time, I just found that thoughts about food were popping into my mind all the time. And I was walking to the fridge and I found that I was engaging in eating when I wasn't hungry. I knew I wasn't hungry. And so I decided to make this my practice and to investigate what was actually going on. And so the thoughts about food would even come up during my sitting practice. And I remember a very wise question from a wise teacher of mine who said, if you find that you have a lot of repetitive thinking, ask yourself, what's fueling this thinking? So what's fueling the thinking? And so when I asked myself that question, I was able to get underneath the thoughts, which were emotions, unpleasant emotions. And what was interesting about it wasn't one particular emotion. It was just a whole slew of subtle, unpleasant emotions like restlessness, boredom. There might have been a bit of, you know, anxiety there, procrastination. And so the minute I felt that unpleasantness, I wanted to self-medicate with food, essentially. So there was the cycle of emotional eating. And so I don't know if you know the habit loop, but basically you have a cue, a behavior, and then a reward. And I just kept reinforcing it. So I'd have the thought about food. I'd have the impulse. So I'd feel the impulse in my body wanting to get up. I'd get up, go to the fridge, have something to eat, got that little shot of dopamine, and there goes the cycle. And so what we, I don't know if, you know, what many of us don't realize is that we're reinforcing that habit and the neural pathways in the brain. And so the more we do it, the more entrenched the habit becomes. And so mindfulness, again, brings a lot of this into the light of awareness so that we can begin to decondition those behaviors that are not serving us well. Again, we've got to see it first, and then we have to have the, you know, the tools and the training to know when to interrupt that pattern. And often we need to interrupt it when it's most strong, like during an impulse of wanting to eat. So being able to stay with that unpleasant impulse.
We are having probably a lot of impulses right now as we are isolated and at home. And as I mentioned right off the top of the podcast, anxiety, uncertainty, you know, there's a plethora. We could like list 10 things right now that are affecting us as a society too, every single day. How can people begin this process of learning how to sit, or saying to themselves, let's learn how to do this? How during this time can it be of its greatest benefit by starting to practice mindfulness?
Yeah, I mean, it's a loaded question. And again, it's not a one size fits all approach. So it's really hard to advise. And because there's so many different things out there, I mean, it's also a really amazing time to tap into some of the opportunities that are out there with some world-class teachers offering all of these online opportunities to sit with them. And so I would just say, dive in and try it out and see if this is for you. But I do think it's important to build some kind of habit around it and to stick with it, because otherwise, you know, if we're not directing the attention, we can kind of get scattered with it. And so I would just encourage people to maybe explore, try different teachers. And I'm a bit biased, but I do find that the 8-week MBSR is a great place to start, because you not only have a group of people that you're sitting with, you have the teacher, there's the weekly, you know, meeting with them, there's the home practice, and so the ability to develop the habit around it. And just the, you know, the support of the group. So that's where I would often invite people to start. But there's so many other programs out there, including apps. And I think some of these apps are great. I you know, I don't know how people feel about them in terms of not having that one, you know, that contact. But we're living in a different world now anyway. So the contact is quite different. A lot of these programs are going to have to be run online. I will be offering one, an MBSR online in the fall if things don't go back to normal, which it doesn't look like they're going to be at this point.
There's definitely, I think we're going to be adjusting to a very new normal for sure. And so I want to allow people, and I think let's try something right now, because we still have a couple minutes to go, but for people to not say, am I doing it wrong? Mm-hmm. You know, how is this going to feel? If it doesn't work within the first two times that they sit, like, that's what drives me nuts. Is like, I finally will convince friends to give this a try. Like, okay. I will get them to the point where they're like, okay, you know, and I'm like, just start with. So for me, I was always like, start 5 minutes on the Headspace app. That's how I got my start, right? And so I have like this commitment for like 2-3 days and they're with it. And then, you know, on day five, it's just like, So why is it that people feel like they're doing it wrong, or it's not working for me? You know, like, it's like they took so much of a leap of faith by sitting for the first time, and yet there's they give up on it so quickly.
Yeah, I think it just, I mean, when I heard you say that, I think, what did you say? You know, I'm not doing it right. Or so I think part of it is just understanding or having a misunderstanding of what it is that they should be experienced. So it sounds to me like people have an expectation of what they should be experiencing. And so what we often do at the beginning is to invite this beginner's mind and to really open ourselves up to whatever is happening. And so if you feel like you're practicing because you have a particular goal in mind, or it's just not working for me, like, what does that mean to you? Like, that's what I heard you say. You said, this is not working for me. Well, what does that mean exactly? What is not working? You know, so if people are saying that, what is their expectation around it? And so I think if they understand what they're supposed to be doing and they stick with the instructional set and just stick with it for a certain period of time and then just see how do they feel in their own experience. Is this benefiting me? Is it not? And then take it from there. But to open ourselves up to whatever we're going to get from the experience rather than imposing this is the way it should look like. I should be able to blank my mind or I should feel relaxed during this practice or I should feel relaxed after the practice and I'm not. And so I'm going to give up. So that's, we got to scrap all of that, you know? And so it's really bring this beginner's mind set, you know, maybe you do it for 2 weeks every day just to see what happens and then see for yourself. Is it helping you? I mean, you said it yourself. You find that this has been a game changer. I'm not sure what you know benefits that you've noticed in the first year.
Well, yeah. I mean, first off, and I've been very lucky that I have the support of my family, and because I think I'm a much better mother and wife and friend when I get my workout in and I get my meditation in. I'm physically and mentally fit, like helping my body. I feel like I need to do the exercise and I need to train my mind also. Mm-hmm. And when it's done, I am a much better, kinder, less bitchier person, right? So yeah. Just like you said, right, the kids can recognize when it hasn't been done. But yeah, so for me, I really have felt a massive shift over the last year. And I think when I'm most upset with myself is, and this is where I think it's interesting when people say it's not working for me, is sometimes now when I lose my shit on the kids or something gets to me and I lash out, that's when I'm most upset with myself now, because I know that I should have taken the second to process, and almost that I get mad that the meditation at that point didn't work. Does that make any sense? It's kind of like I knew better, and there was that reaction that I haven't quite yet been able to. I didn't come back. I didn't have an anchor to come back to.
But that's amazing because you know the difference now. Right. You know the difference between reactivity and when you do lose it. So I think the key piece that you can bring into that is this non-judgment towards yourself when it isn't perfect. Really important not to judge ourselves, but the fact that you notice the difference and you notice the benefit of the non-reaction, and it's not a linear process. The learning is not linear, and you know, sometimes we'll slip back and sometimes, you know, so I think that's also important to bring into it.
And I think too, right, I started with 5 minutes. I now can do 30, and you know, I get upset when the timer goes off or I'm supposed to open my eyes. For me, I and you said, like, we all have something different. I actually feel a different energy. Like I can feel a tingling through my head and my temple. Like I just feel like almost like there's a rewiring of my brain as it's happening. Right. And so that's when I'm most, that's when I feel like a lightness when I am in the meditation, is that I feel like there's just like these tingling sensations going on in my brain. Then I tell myself that it's a gift that I'm giving to myself, right? The opportunity for it to kind of just ease itself off of the negative thought or the future thoughts or the monkey brain or everything else that you had mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. That's great. Yeah. So that's great. And I think, you know, part of the reason I would recommend like an 8-week is that I think people in the West in particular, and I think the way my dad started is that he had an Asian teacher who didn't explain anything, the why. Whereas I think that Westerners really want to understand why they're doing this and why is it important and what is it supposed to produce. And so if we do have some kind of that, you know, that understanding as well, where are we headed with this, then I really do think that those teachings are very supportive to a practice. And so an 8-week program, you're going to get that, you know, we're going to talk about perceptions and thoughts and how they work, and reactivity will, you know, usually in week 4 and 5, we start to see that by week 5, people are noticing that they're a lot less reactive in their life and that they're able to pause and respond rather than react. And when those light bulbs go off in the class, I'm telling you, it's amazing to see in 5 weeks.
Okay, can you do it in 5 minutes? Can you take us through for someone who actually hasn't light? I'm like right on the timing here. If for those of you who are finished your walk or you're, you know, maybe you've done, you know, usually I would say you're, you know, commuting to work. A lot of people listened when they were commuting. That's not happening right now. But or even like just 3 minutes of what it would sound like. Like what does the sensation of going through this practice sound like when you actually have a teacher with you?
Okay. I mean, I can do a three minute practice, but just so you know, I mean, this is very, basic. I'm just going to do a little breath awareness practice. And so basically you just want to find a posture that feels supportive. And since we're sitting on chairs, maybe we'll just guide from here. And so the feet can be uncrossed and flat on the floor. So you want to feel like you have a solid base. And the spine can be upright but not rigid. So we want to be relaxed yet awake. So again, it's not about inducing relaxation. It's about being awake yet relaxed. And so you can just allow the hands to rest comfortably in the lap, however that might be for you. And then the chin can just be slightly tucked. And once again, with the eyes, you can either leave them open or just cast downward 2 to 3 feet in front of you. And so usually when we begin a practice, we might just take a few deep breaths. Just to settle the body. Just taking them at your own rhythm and pace. So breathing in deeply. And then just letting go. One more in-breath. And then exhaling, letting go. And then as you settle into the posture, you may notice a variety of sensations in the body. There may be sounds in the environment, thoughts and emotions may be present. Just noticing what's here. And now deliberately directing your attention to your breathing, wherever it's most vividly felt in the body, and then allowing all other aspects of your experience to recede into the background. So allowing your breath to be in the foreground of your experience. Just feeling the breath as it's moving in and through the body. So we're not thinking about the breath, but feeling it directly. So breathing in and knowing that you're breathing in, and breathing out and knowing that you're breathing out. And at some point you'll notice that the mind has wandered off the breath. Once again, this is not a problem. This is what minds do. So the invitation is to simply notice where the mind has gone off to without getting lost in the content or story, and then gently but firmly bringing the attention back to the next breath. Feeling the breath moving in and out of the body. And just doing this for the next few breaths until you hear the sound of the bell.
Okay, give me a second here. Need like a second to come out. So that just felt actually really good. For you, that there was talking through it, but if you're getting into a longer one, the space between when you're talking to us becomes further and further apart. That there's not constantly a voice that's there.
Yeah. And again, depending on where people are at in the practice, some people really like the guidance. And again, with a longer practice, I'm taking you through different aspects of your experience. That was just one aspect of it. And so, yeah, there, and you can guide in different ways where there'd be way more periods of silence or more talking for beginners, because I find that with beginners, they do tend to prefer a little more guidance. And the more experience you get, I find I like doing silent meditations. So just without any guidance, but from time to time, even now, I will put on a recording just because my mind is so much busier and I feel I just need that additional support. So there's no right or wrong way.
Okay. I'm just going to put you through like a fireside real firing you off questions. If you had three people that you would, besides yourself, because I'm going to put your links in, and who would be some of the three biggest people for you that you would sit and enjoy their meditations or feel like it's along the lines that speak to you?
Well, I mean, I have the teachers that I follow, and so they tend to be, the teachers out of Spirit Rock Meditation Center and IMS, so the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts. So, Joseph Goldstein is one of them, and Tara Brach, who I love as well. And, there's so many, I don't really want to single anyone out. I think the key thing is to settle on the kind of practice you want to do. And so the kind that I'm drawn to and the teachers I follow is insight meditation, which is Vipassana. And so there are so many amazing teachers out there. So I do feel a little uncomfortable singling any one particular teacher out. And some of them aren't, some amazing teachers that aren't super well known, but are amazing, guiding. And dharmaseed.org has a lot of recordings of different meditations and Dharma talks. So it's also a great resource. My website has a resource page with links. And so that would be one.
And and what would be like the top book for you? The book that opened up?
Jeez, gosh, that's another tough one. It's hard to say. So I started off with Jon Kabat-Zinn's book. What is it? Wherever You Are Here. What is it? Wherever You Are. I can't even remember the title exactly, but that's where I started. There's so many books. I have a link. And I find that depending on where I'm at in this process, I'm drawn to different books. I also really enjoyed Rick Hansen's Resilient, and really this practice is about resilience. We're building resilience. We're learning to sit in the middle of it all. And so we're building these skills. So I really resonated a lot with that particular book. But again, it's really hard to just, single one book out.
I love that you do mention the resilience. That's a big part of what it is that this is right now, right? We are building up our resilience to what we are going through.
Yeah, absolutely. And they do say there is a link between mindfulness and resilience. And resilience is really about we gain this skill by turning the attention inward. And it's about how we perceive stressors and how we react to them. And so through these practices, we're given the tools to be with these difficult experiences and meet them in different, more creative ways, I guess you could say. Mm. So it is
It's beautiful. I mean, I've gone way over, as I'm looking at the time and stuff that we were chatting. I want people to know. So in our show notes, of course, I'm going to have your website, but on that website you were talking about, there's lots of resources and links and places to go for more information.
Yeah, there's absolutely. So the questions that you've just asked me that I feel I totally did not answer well are in terms of books and things like that. And teachers, there are many different things on my website that would guide people in different directions. And I think the key message is that it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. So it's really important to resonate with the teacher in the practice. And so I think that's more important, is to listen to what feels right for each person.
I think just even for someone to think that this is something they're going to try or be open-minded to, you've won half the battle right there in just being open-minded to it. I never got to ask you about being the spy. I'm picturing Jennifer Garner in Alias. Is that about right?
You know what? If I told you about my job, I'd have to kill you.
That's the perfect. That is where we are going to wrap things up. I love it. I really do. Jennifer, thank you so much for the time. As I mentioned, we will get all of those that information up in the show notes, so you have the resources and the links. And I'm asking of you, right? This is the perfect time. You can't use the excuse that you don't have time. That's probably the number one excuse people would say. I just don't have time to do this. So you do have time now, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think the people who say they don't have the time maybe are the ones who probably need it even more, right? Because it just gives you a little bit of spaciousness into your day. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I just quickly say before we sign off in terms of the no time is that I think the time you put into the practice, you get back 10 times more in terms of your ability to focus and be productive and just, all the other benefits that it brings. So it's really a gift.
Yeah. That's perfect. I'm going to end it right there. Jennifer, thank you so much. And to everyone listening, thanks again for listening to yet another episode of Living Your Life with Leanne Lang.
Thanks so much, Leanne.
You looking to make the most out of this life and optimize your personal wellness? Then check out the Natural Man Podcast. Join me, host Mike C., as we explore all areas of human wellness, physical, mental, and emotional. Learn strategies to optimize your own well-being and be in the driver's seat of your own health. Remember, your doctor works for you. Learn biohacks, neurohacks, ways to improve sleep, and ways to optimize your body and your mind. Check us out on Apple, Spotify, the Fountain app, and at naturalmanpodcast.com.